Order.
Parliament resumed at 2 on Tuesday, back from a fortnight's adjournment, during which there was just the one select committee meeting, and that was closed to the public. So once again, we had to take to the corridors, calling on the Clerk of the House, David Wilson, for guidance on what happens following the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPPA. I began by asking him if Parliament can make changes to a treaty.
Well, no, it can't directly do that. The signing of treaties and foreign affairs is really a prerogative of the executive. And in recent years, Parliament has had a role in scrutinising treaties before they come into force. But really, Parliament's role is to scrutinise, to draw to the attention of the House any problems it sees, but it doesn't have the ability to change a treaty. What it can do, though, is where treaties require legislation to implement them, it can certainly amend that legislation in any way that it likes.
How does it get to do that? Does the government then introduce legislation, or does it table the treaty? What happens? What's the process?
Well, there's quite a lengthy process for Parliament considering treaties. They are first presented to the House by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and they stand referred to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, which can either keep the treaty and look at it itself, or allocate it to another committee, depending on the subject matter of the treaty. The committee has 15 sitting days, so 15 parliamentary days, to have a look at the treaty, and in that time, the government has agreed that it won't take any further action to implement the treaty. So that gives Parliament a bit of time to look at it. So the committee does that. When it reports to the House, it might identify any issues with the treaty that it wants to draw to its attention. Then the government is free to carry on with the implementation of the treaty, to respond to any recommendations made by the committee. And then if the treaty requires legislation to bring it into effect, as the recent one for the free trade agreement with South Korea did, then that's introduced to the House and proceeds like any other piece of legislation.
And what happens if the government fails to pass legislation implementing the treaty?
If it did that, and it simply wouldn't be able to implement the treaty. And I guess that would be part of a wider problem for a government that was unable to implement its legislative program.
Can the government introduce legislation to implement a treaty's obligations before the House has considered the committee's report on it?
It could do that, but the government's agreed that it will wait the 15 sitting days while the Select Committee looks at the treaty before it takes any further action. And that's a convention that's set out both in standing orders and in the Cabinet Manual. But there's nothing in law to stop it doing that, but it wouldn't benefit from the scrutiny of the Select Committee.
So when the treaty is with the Select Committee, does the public get a chance to make submissions?
Yes, it's up to the Select Committee, as it is with all of the business that comes before committees, whether or not to call for public submissions. They have done in the case of some treaties that have been referred to them, and the recent free trade agreement with South Korea was an example, where they received a small number of public submissions and heard some of those. So it's certainly free to do that. The limiting factor is the fact that it only has 15 sitting days to consider it, and so the time for making submissions is usually quite short.
With the South Korea treaty, did that result in any amendment to an act?
Yes, there was an amendment to the Tariff Act 1988 to change some of the tariff limits to give effect to the Free Trade Agreement.
Prior to 1998, this process didn't exist, did it? It was the government could just sign a treaty with a foreign power and Parliament didn't have any say at all. What led to the government relinquishing this control over its own actions?
Well, you're right. Prior to 1998, there was no role for Parliament in considering or approving treaties at all. So for a few years prior to that, it was felt that that arrangement was not satisfactory. And in 1996, the Clerk of the House, David McGee, prepared a paper suggesting changes and a role for Parliament in scrutinising treaties. That was picked up a couple of years later by the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee in an inquiry they did into Parliament's role with treaties, and they recommended that it play the role that it currently does, have the opportunity to scrutinise treaties for a short period of time. That proposal was picked up by Parliament in 1998, and they experimented by making what's called a sessional order, so a temporary change to Parliament's rules to try this process out and see how it worked. Parties generally felt it was successful, and so the next change of standing orders for 1999, that was adopted and became part of the rules of the House. And since that time, that process has applied to all of the treaties that have been referred by the government to Parliament.
When the government tables a treaty in the House, there's a national interest analysis. Who prepares that and what is it for?
Well, that's prepared by government officials as part of this process for the Parliament to consider treaties. And it sets out the case for and against the treaty, the obligations that it creates, the effects of the treaty, any costs involved, any compliance costs in implementing the treaty, and the consultation process that has gone through. It also sets out whether there are any provisions to withdraw from the treaty at a later stage. So the idea with that is to give the select committee that's considering it and the public who might be interested or who might want to make a submission the opportunity to have some information which otherwise wouldn't be available to them. And the text of the treaty by itself isn't likely to be so informative to the public. So the national interest analysis is a requirement of standing orders and is something that the committee will append to its report as well. So it's considered really the primary document for the public to have information about the effects of a treaty.
The Clerk of the House, David Wilson. Leaving his office, we move up the corridor and round the corner to the Bill's office, prompted by this item off the agenda for the week ahead from Jerry Brownlee's business statement.
Wednesday, sir, will be a Members' Day.
And as Rhys Lyon discovered at the Bill's office, among the first readings on Wednesday night's order paper is a Members' Bill aimed across the chamber from one member to another.
A bill near the top of the Members' order paper is one in the name of Labour's Titai Hararo MP, Adrian Ruafe, which seeks to bring parliamentary undersecretaries into the scope of the Official Information Act, or OIA. The Official Information Parliamentary Undersecretaries Amendment Bill would ensure that information held by parliamentary undersecretaries in their official capacity can be subject to requests under the Official Information Act 1982. There's been provision for the appointment of parliamentary undersecretaries since 1936, a role most recently enshrined in the Constitution Act of 1986. There's only one in the current parliament, and that's ACT Party leader David Seymour. I spoke to him about his take on the bill and asked him to begin by explaining his role as a parliamentary undersecretary.
Well, my role is that I am assigned specific duties by the ministers, in my case the Minister for Regulatory Reform and the Minister for Education. I am a parliamentary undersecretary to those ministers, and each of them have assigned me different duties. So in each of those areas, I do not make decisions, but what I do is come up with proposals upon which the relevant minister decides.
And so how would your role as a parliamentary undersecretary differ from that of an associate minister?
Well, an associate minister can actually sign off and make decisions, whereas as an undersecretary, when reports come through from the department, generally the instruction for the undersecretary is to note, whereas the instructions for the minister is often decide or approve.
And you're the only MP with the title of parliamentary undersecretary at present, is that right?
That's correct, but I'm far from the first. Bill English, the Deputy Prime Minister, first entered the executive as an undersecretary, and I think it's relevant to this particular discussion that the Labour Party has made use of this position in the past. Most recently, I understand Helen Clark appointed Dover Samuels as an undersecretary. It's actually a position that's existed in the Constitution Act since 1986.
Parliamentary undersecretaries are not subject to the OIA and also aren't subject to questions and question time. Do you think they should be?
I'm in two minds. In one sense, I couldn't care less because I already behave as though I'm subject to the OIA, which is a prudent way for anyone to behave as in politics, is to assume that what you do could end up on the front page of the paper. And what's more, anything I do that ultimately becomes official and leads to a ministerial decision has to go through the minister's office and is therefore subject to the OIA. So in one sense, It would not make a significant difference to me. In fact, probably no practical difference if Under Secretary is subject to the OIA. However, there does need to be some proportion in the law. And I think the question that the proponents of this bill have to ask themselves is if you have no ultimate decision-making ability and if documents and transactions you undertake but do lead to ministerial decisions by the executive are already subject to the OIA through the minister, then what exactly is the purpose of this legislation? If it's so important, why did the Labor Party not do this when they had undersecretaries in their government? And I suspect what you see here is a junior member of the Labor Party. I think Adrian Ruafe is a first-timer in Parliament, and he's probably been given a bill that he doesn't really understand or believe in himself, but somebody in the Labor caucus had to put it in the ballot, and through the luck of the angels, he's had this particular bill drawn.
Would you see some benefit, though, in being able to be subjected to questions and question time?
Well, I'm able to answer questions on behalf of the minister by choice, but I'm not required to answer questions. And the truth is that it's been controversial in the House, as you'll know, but from time to time, people do actually transfer questions. The Prime Minister sometimes transfers questions to other ministers, for instance. So it's actually hard to say that anybody is especially required to answer a question. But hypothetically, were I to be forced to answer questions on my undersecretarial work in Parliament, I would have to give the answer that this is the advice I formulated for a minister, but I can't actually be held to account for the final decision because I don't make the final decision. So I think while it's probably not a bad political stunt for the Labor Party to put a bill like this in, once you start to work through the practicalities of what it would mean, you find that there's a lot of hot air and not much substance.
You probably already indicated the answer to the next question, but have you been approached by Adrian Ruafe and would you vote in favour of the bill?
I've never been approached by him. As I've said, I'm pretty ambivalent, but simply for the reasons of the practicalities of you know, actually what it would mean, the importance of the information that would be uncovered, given that there's no final decision-making power, given that truly official information I handle has to end up in the minister's office so he or she can make a decision, and given that there has to be some proportionality in the law. You know, is this law proportional for the costs it imposes to the benefits it derives? Probably not, so I'd vote against it. And one thing that people forget about the OIA is that while I'm entirely in favour of the executive being held to account, open government and citizens being able to get information about what the executive's up to, there is actually an enormous cost. OIA requests are sometimes refused because the cost of collecting the information is so large. Sometimes requesters are asked to actually pay to compensate that cost. And so one thing it would do is that it would mean that more of my and my staff's time would be filled up completing Official Information Act requests, even though we have no ultimate decision-making power. And so for me, that would be disproportionate lawmaking. The costs would thoroughly outweigh the benefits derived. And of course, you know that it would be the Labor Party who would be the first to complain if I had to employ extra people to fulfil their OIA request.
ACT MP for Epsom, David Seymour. And Adrian Ruafe's bill is the third on the members' order paper, behind Phil Goff's Education Charter Schools Curriculum Amendment Bill and Carmel Cipollone's Social Workers Registration Mandatory Registration Amendment Bill.
Rhys Lyon, And when Parliament resumed at 2 on Tuesday, question time was dominated by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, starting with this question from the opposition leader, Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his statement that, quotes, "I don't want to ban foreigners from buying residential property," end quotes?
Speaker. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by my full statement, which went on to say I don't think there's actually good public policy that works, and around New Zealand there would be a whole lot of people who'd say I don't want to stop an Australian buying a house in Queenstown or an American buying a place in the Bay of Islands or actually people buying a house in Wellington.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Does he accept that it is a loss of New Zealand's sovereignty if future parliaments cannot pass laws without being sued to stop TPPA nationals buying our homes?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, I don't. I believe that's the case because, in fact, the Labor Party not only supported but actually helped with negotiations of FTAs for which they were a party which does exactly that.
Commentary.
Order. Order. The Leader of the Opposition is standing to ask a supplementary question, but the level of interjection coming from his own colleagues is unacceptable. Andrew Little. Andrew Little, supplementary question.
Why did his government fail to protect the sovereign right of New Zealand to limit foreign buying of existing houses when the Australian government was able to do it?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I know the members had so many positions on TPP, it's embarrassing.
Order.
But actually, he's just continuing to show he doesn't even understand how it still works, because the Australian government had negotiated its position around bans of foreigners buying houses long before TPPA came along.
Supplementary question, Tim McIndoe.
Thank you, sir. Has the Prime Minister received advice on whether New Zealanders can freely buy residential property in other developed countries?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I have. I'm advised that New Zealanders can buy residential property with few, if any, restrictions in at least the following OECD countries: Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Chile, Estonia, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Ireland, Italy, Japan, Luxembourg, Mexico, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the Slovak Republic, Slovenia, Spain, Sweden, Turkey, the United Kingdom and the United States. Mr. Speaker, that tells me that more than ever that New Zealand's future lies in being open and connected with the rest of the world, which is overwhelmingly should be the case and is far less xenophobic than the Labor Party is.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
What advice has he received from the Trade Minister on our efforts to carve out protection for the right of New Zealand to limit foreigners buying existing homes, as Australia has done, as Malaysia has done, and as Singapore has done?
Speaker,
the Right Honourable
Speaker,
Prime
Australia
Minister.
Had those provisions prior to going into TPP. What the government did do as part of the carve-out that it wanted to follow, which was to allow extra taxes to be applied for foreigners who buy property in New Zealand, if the government of the day deemed that to be possible. Why? Because that will work. What won't work is a ban on foreigners. It didn't work in Australia and it wouldn't work in New Zealand.
Doesn't stand up for New Zealand.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
When Tim Grocer described the deal as having dead rats, did he mean the meagre increase in access for dairy exports over an extended period of time, higher costs for medicines, and the loss of sovereignty over who owns our land?
Why won't you stand up,
Mr. Speaker?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, what Tim Grocer was meaning when he very successfully, on behalf of New Zealand, I personally want to congratulate him, negotiated TPP, was that he was going to give this country access to 40% of the global economy with 93% tariff-free, Mr. Speaker. But, Mr. Speaker, I look at this quote, Mr. Speaker, and I hear these words ringing in my ears. What always haunts a Prime Minister is, will there be a series of trade blocks developed that you are not part of? Because that is unthinkable for New Zealand as an export-orientated small trading economy. Once again, I agree with Helen Clark, just like I did in New York a few days ago.
Order. 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 Supplementary question, Tim McIntyre.
Thank you, sir. Further question to the Prime Minister. How would a ban on foreigners buying residential property sit within New Zealand's network of trade agreements?
Well, as well as TPP, such a ban would be inconsistent with CER, the Singapore FTA, our agreement with Chinese Taipei, our FTA with Korea, and as a consequence, our FTA with China. New Zealand entered those agreements in good faith with support from both sides of the House. It would, Mr. Speaker, be a sad day for New Zealand's international credibility if a party started picking and choosing with bits of an agreement to blatantly flout it. Yeah.
Supplementary. Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
In light of that answer, why has his government introduced, in fact, passed legislation requiring foreign buyers to register with IRD and have a New Zealand bank account?
Are the Right Honourable Prime Minister?
Mr. Speaker, because government's interested in getting more information on foreigners and happy for them to pay taxes, which is exactly the very point that we negotiated in TPP.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why does the TPPA compel Pharmac to reveal its negotiating strategy to drug companies when his own government itself said it would be insanity for a party to negotiate or to give away its negotiation strategy to the other side?
The Right Honourable
Mr. Speaker, because we're quite comfortable that those provisions won't see any change in material change in the way that Pharmac operates. And Mr. Speaker, if one looks at TPP in its wider context with all of them, I agree with this. There are huge advantages for being involved with TPP and even bigger disadvantages of being locked out. They were said with force, they were said with meaning, they were said by the leader of the Labor Party, they were said by Phil Goff in 2013.
Order. Order.
Andrew Little's deputy, Annette King, had a specific question about one aspect of the TPPA, directed at Health Minister Jonathan Coleman.
What is the estimated cost to Vote Health of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Mr. Speaker, the best estimate of the cost to Vote Health from the TPPA is $4.5 million in one-off costs and $2.2 million per year in ongoing operating costs to Pharmac. That is a tiny 0.014 of 1% of the $15.9 billion health budget. The government does not foresee any additional cost to Pharmac from the provisions relating to biologic drugs. Consumers will not pay more for subsidised medicines as a result of TPPA. Most prescribed medicines are fully subsidised, and New Zealanders will still pay no more than $5 per prescription item. The TPP does not change this in any way. Pharmac's ability to negotiate with drug companies to keep prices down is unchanged.
Question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
What has he been informed are the, quote, comparable outcomes, end quote, to enable New Zealand to deliver a longer period than the current 5 years data exclusivity on biologics under the TPP?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
The point underlying that question is that we don't need to make any change to our policy settings to fulfil the requirements of TPP.
Order.
Question I asked, has he been informed what are the comparable outcomes?
I'll allow the member to repeat the question.
What has he been informed are, quote, comparable outcomes to enable New Zealand to deliver a longer period than the current 5 years on data exclusivity on biologics under the TPP?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan
Well,
Coleman.
They're those delivered by the existing policy measures. So you've got 20-year patent protection. That remains intact. That is going to exceed the 5-year data protection. And when you put that together with MedSafe process, that actually meets the requirements of the TPPA.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
Has he been informed what a comparable outcome would mean in actual years added on to the 5-year data exclusivity protection in New Zealand with changes negotiated under the TPP?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Well, there won't be any change because our existing policy framework meets all the requirements of the TPP.
That's true.
Entry question, the Honourable Annette King.
What will be the cost to the health of New Zealanders of a one-year delay in making biologic drugs available in light of an article in the Medical Journal of Australia which states pharmaceutical monopoly protections cost Australia taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars each year?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan
Coleman. Well, Mr Speaker, don't forget, this is the member that said TPP would cost a billion dollars.
Order. It's a very simple question that's been asked of the Minister. Be advised and answer it, please.
It's a very complex hypothetical question. What I've said is that there will be no added cost. It won't be the $1 billion that Annette King said would be added.
I'll hear from the Honourable Annette King.
The Minister has to bring in the Labor Party into the answer when it was a straightforward question.
My patience will probably run out fairly quickly with this member. The question was not attempted to be answered in the first place. I took issue with the Minister and he now has, to my satisfaction, addressed the question. If the member has further supplementaries, that is the way to proceed. I'll hear from the... Yes, you can. The Minister can complete his answer
briefly. I just want to clarify, it won't cost $1 billion a year, as Annette King said. It won't cost lives, as Annette King said. And most importantly of all, it won't undermine the Pharmac model, as Annette King said. So, quite frankly, she needs to apologise to New Zealanders and stop trying to...
Order!
And there was a question for the Trade Minister, Tim Grosser, from his New Zealand First Party shadow, Fletcher Tabato.
Will he release the full details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership text immediately, given that the 12 Asia-Pacific countries have successfully concluded their negotiations?
The Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr Speaker, the government will release the texts as soon as it possibly can, but it will not be a unilateral decision of the New Zealand government. This is a partnership among 12 countries. And everyone has recognised that there is absolutely legitimate and intense interest in some quarters in seeing the whole picture. This is fully understood and we agree is a completely legitimate position. But we are waiting until our experts can reach an agreement that as much of the text that can be available, and on some estimates we're talking thousands of pages, will be released as soon as is humanly possible.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, Fletcher Tabato.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Can the Minister deny that the non-discrimination provision within this agreement will mean that this government will not be able to protect New Zealand citizens when they are buying New Zealand homes? Instead, they will forever have to compete with overseas investors from the TPPA nations.
The Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr Speaker, it's really very unusual to find people trying to assess a trade agreement in terms of Auckland house prices. The reality has already been spelt out by numerous ministers. You know where we stand. We want to send a message of connectivity to the rest of the world. We realise New Zealand First is in a totally different space.
Trade Minister Tim Grosser in question time was followed by a request to the Speaker, David Carter, for a snap debate on the TPPA.
I have also received a letter from the Leader of the Opposition seeking to debate under Standing Order 389 the Government's announcement that it has concluded negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The announcement is a particular case of recent occurrence involving ministerial responsibility. I understand that the text of the agreement is to be released to the public. Before the agreement is ratified, it will be subject to parliamentary treaty examination process set out in Standing Orders 397 to 400. I understand that legislation is also required to give effect to the agreement, which will again give opportunity for parliamentary debate. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is a significant agreement which should be debated by this House. There will be opportunities for parliamentary consideration of it in the future with the benefit of the text of the agreement and the national interest analysis. I am not convinced that at this stage the business of the House ought to be set aside to debate the matter.
And that's it for this week. More details on our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was brought to you with funding from Parliament.